Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, a look at soccer's World Cup. But first, one corner of that world. It's been a bloody week in Afghanistan. A bombing last night killed at least 40 people at a wedding party. The Taliban is denying responsibility, perhaps because so many civilians were killed. But the Taliban launched a major offensive this week, killing at least 23 foreign troops. Yesterday, Defense Secretary Gates warned that there has to be more progress soon in Afghanistan for Americans to stay behind the war effort. And today, General Stanley McChrystal, the top U.S. commander in Afghanistan, said he was slowing down on a major offensive against the Taliban in the Kandahar region because the military hasn't yet won the hearts and minds of local leaders there. Washington Post editor and senior foreign correspondent Rajiv Chandrasekaran is just back from Afghanistan. Rajiv, this wedding party attack, the government says it was a suicide bomber because family members are police officers. They'd been supportive of the West. But the groom's cousin says he saw helicopters. So first, could this have been a mistaken missile attack?
Well, anything's possible in Afghanistan, although the NATO military command there has been pretty unequivocal in denying that it had any involvement in this. Certainly, the connection of some of the victims to the police force may have been a reason for this to have been targeted by the Taliban, if indeed that is what happened. Mm-hmm. But as you mentioned, certainly the sheer number of civilians in there has led the Taliban to perhaps a step back from claiming responsibility for this act.
Well, and the Taliban certainly hasn't been shy about killings. Yesterday, they reportedly hanged a 7-year-old boy that they had accused of spying. Rajiv, you were in Afghanistan reporting on the aftermath of the U.S. offensive against the Taliban in Marja. This happened earlier this year. The Taliban were expelled, but we know they've returned. So your thoughts on Marja and how it might relate to the proposed operation in Kandahar this summer that we now hear General McChrystal wants to slow down?
Well, there's been a set of very worrisome developments in Marja. When the U.S. Marines, backed up by Afghan soldiers, went in, their plan was to sort of do everything right and turn Marja into sort of a model for how the new U.S. counterinsurgency strategy, backed up by more troops dispatched by President Obama, could start to turn the tide against the Taliban and generate more momentum. They went in with a plan to work with the Afghan government to deliver basic services. They went in with a plan to have lots of Afghan police and soldiers participating in the security mission there. And they went in with a lot of force designed to really push the Taliban out. And in the early weeks, they thought they really had achieved a degree of success. What now appears to be clear is that the Taliban were just laying low, trying to understand what the Marines were going to be doing there and to assess their vulnerabilities. And what's happened is over the past several weeks, the Taliban have sort of roared back. It's not that they have reclaimed this area. The Marines are still there, but the Taliban is engaged in a campaign of intimidation, a campaign of assassinations of Afghans, and other acts designed to make very clear to the local population, hey, we're still around, we can control the night. And what it has resulted in has been a real delay in the effort to secure the area, to bring reconstruction and development assistance there. What U.S. commanders had hoped would be an example of how the strategy is working and sort of a beacon of change, instead is now serving as a bit of a cautionary tale for U.S. commanders as well as Afghan officials, and they are looking to see how they can avoid duplicating some of these mistakes in Kandahar. And a real big question and a big disappointment has been, even though the Afghan government has promised to have civil servants out in Marja delivering basic services, a lot of those people haven't really showed up in Marja to do their jobs.
Well, just a quick question, Rajiv. You write that most Afghans would rather not live under the thumb of the Taliban in Marja. So is that the problem, that they can't count on their own government and civil servants to help them out?
Most Afghans in places like Marja, yes, would rather not live under the Taliban, but they're uncertain about the future. They don't know whether their government is going to be still standing in a year's time. They're not sure whether the United States and NATO forces are going to be there in a couple of years' time. And they're worried that if they stick their head out and cast their lot with the government and with NATO, that they may be essentially marked for execution or retribution in a world where their government and and international forces are unable to deliver security to these areas over the long term.
That's Washington Post editor and senior foreign correspondent Rajiv Chandrasekaran, just back from Afghanistan. We'll link you to his writing at our website, hereandnow.org. Rajiv, thanks so much.
A pleasure to talk to you.
And by the way, on Monday, Sebastian Younger, author of War, will weigh in with his views on Afghanistan. That's Monday on Here and Now. Well, it's that time again, so hit it. Soccer fans will be in full voice tomorrow when host nation South Africa meets Mexico in the opening match of the 2010 World Cup soccer games. The U.S. plays England on Saturday. Where it all goes from there, nobody knows. Although, as Stephen and Harrison Stark write, one thing is certain, the whole world will be watching. Stephen Stark and his son Harrison are co-authors of World Cup 2010, The Indispensable Guide to Soccer and Geopolitics. It is a terrific roadmap. Player profiles, predictions, fascinating history. Did you know that a dictator once imprisoned the Cote d'Ivoire team for 2 days because they lost? And that Holland's defeat in 1974 was that country's biggest trauma apart from the floods of 1953 and World War II. There are also team tactics and a Beatles song that best describes each country's team. And Stephen and Harrison both join us in our studios with more. Welcome.
Great to be here.
Great to be here.
And you write that these 2010 games come at a crossroads for the sport. Why?
They come at a crucial time because more and more players are playing their professional soccer abroad, not in the countries they grew up in. When Pele played in the World Cup, the entire team played their professional soccer in Brazil. Now it's maybe only four or five. Argentina's Lionel Messi, widely considered to be the greatest player going into the tournament, hasn't even lived in Argentina since he was 12. He's been living in Barcelona with his club. So there's a question of how Brazilian or Argentinian, for example, some of these players are, and therefore how strong their allegiances to their home countries are going to be.
Isn't the answer that for most of them the allegiance will be to their home country?
It is, although there's sort of two issues. Will the distinctive Brazilian style continue to be quite as distinctive, given that the players aren't there all the time? And most of these players don't get paid very much, if anything, to be in the Cup, whereas they're being paid millions and millions of dollars for their club team. And there have been suggestions that maybe over time the World Cup may become more like baseball's All-Star game, an exhibition in a sense, one worth watching, but not quite the competition it's been in the past.
Wow. I mean, that's hard to imagine now, you know, because now it is so fraught, you know, with so many things, including this year. Let's just get right to it. The first ever in Africa. It's in South Africa. The first ever in a South African country. What does that mean to you?
Oh, it's huge. This is the first event on this scale that Africa has ever hosted. And I think the pride that that continent is taking in presenting itself to the world is immense.
The question is, how big is it going to be for South Africa as a nation? There's a sense in which it's not going to be as big as the Rugby World Cup was just over a decade ago. If you've seen the movie Invictus, that post-apartheid Africa and the underrated rugby team going on to win the tournament, I mean, did wonders for the African
side. Oh, sure. Nelson Mandela coming out to urge on this largely white team led by Matt Damon. Oh, wait, he wasn't really there. But
exactly. Right? There's a sense that it can never be topped, that whatever happens this time is going to be bigger for the continent as a whole, but not quite as formative for South Africa as a country.
Well, and here's where we get into all these fascinating things that, because it's a worldwide sport, all the geopolitical aspects of soccer. And one that might take place that we might watch in South Africa is that there's racism in soccer. You see it in European countries where whites sometimes jeer at black players. Here you're going to have largely white teams coming to a majority black country.
The World Cup is unlike any other competition, even the Olympics. It lasts a month. That's a long time to spend away from home. And in countries we think like Spain or Italy, where there is more racism, where black players have gone on the field and been greeted by monkey chants or they throw banana peels on the field, that could possibly affect the performance of the team.
Because
it's not an environment in which they are as comfortable, certainly as the African teams are going to be, or teams like the United States, which has a fair number of black players on the team, or France or England.
Yeah. Fascinating. And there's all sorts of questions that we've addressed about criticism that South Africa is even doing this, given that there's such poverty largely in the black population. So there's all sorts of stuff going on there. But, you know, take us back a little bit, Stephen, because you write in the introduction to the book that this is what soccer is. It's a window into a culture of a country. Tell us a little bit about that. I mean, what even in the way they play, what are we seeing about
a country? Absolutely. That in the same way that you can learn a lot about Italy through its language or through its food, you can learn a lot about any nation on earth by the way they play soccer and the way their fans relate to it.
So, for instance, Italians might play with an emphasis on artistry, sometimes to the exclusion of scoring goals. You know, they want it to look prettier. Well, you know, beauty is appreciated in Italy. When Brazil fails to win the World Cup, the government launches an investigation?
Absolutely. I mean, that country has made soccer, I think, more of a national priority than any other country. Or take the Dutch. The Dutch are the intellectuals of world soccer. A lot of the great coaches came out of Holland. A lot of the great maneuvers and formations came out of that country. Well, what the Dutch are very adept at doing is creating space on a field, which is what any athlete wants to do. Why is that? Well, in a small country, you know, surrounded by water, creating space is what architects and artists are about.
And that artistic tradition really translates to the field. This is the team that was once advised on tactics by a postmodern sculptor. And their leading striker this time, Robin van Persie, is the son of two prominent artists.
Well, but so tell us more about that. And what do you mean by creating space, Harrison? What does your dad mean?
Well, soccer is a crowded field. And the way you get the ball is you move into open space and people run and take over the space that somebody else was in, and that's how you move the ball up the field. And the Netherlands, for one of the most densely populated countries in Europe, manipulating small amounts of space well is fundamental to the Dutch experience. And that's been expressed through artists like Mondrian, which is all about the manipulation of two-dimensional spaces in new ways, and it translates onto the soccer field.
Oh, my gosh, we're going so deep. I mean, who knew?
But it is deep. It is deep.
And tell us more about that. Why? Why is soccer deep?
Well, I've often said that American sports are very geared towards an ADD-type audience. There's a rush of action, and then there isn't much action at all, whether you're thinking about baseball or football. It's good for a Twitter age. Soccer is a novelistic sport. You need to see it develop over 90 minutes, a very intense concentration to understand the game, and also what we found when we moved overseas. To step into the culture of soccer is like stepping into page 550 of a 1,000-page novel. There's all these things that have been going on before in terms of the history and the players. In that sense, it's a little bit like baseball.
I'm thinking, too, you note that, for instance, when West Germany in 1954 upset Hungary to win the Cup, some historians say this was the spiritual rebirth of Germany after World War II. It was the first thing they were noted for. That wasn't horrible.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, they made a movie about it that was very popular in Germany a couple years ago called The Miracle of Bern, and the premiere came out in tears after seeing the movie. Many nations can date some of the major events in their history over the last 50 years to World Cup sporting events. There's a story we relate in the book where the president of Bolivia once went to the World Cup, and once somebody said to him, well, shouldn't you be attending to state business? And he said, in Bolivia, the World Cup is state business.
That's Stephen Stark. He and son Harrison have written an indispensable guide to World Cup soccer. We'll have more. But staying with sports, congratulations to the Chicago Blackhawks picking up their first Stanley Cup in 49 years. Philadelphia Flyer fans, we have a saying here. Wait till next year. Back in a minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation about soccer on the eve of the World Cup games in South Africa. Our guests are Stephen Stark and his son Harrison, co-authors of World Cup 2010, The Indispensable Guide to Soccer and Geopolitics. Harrison, President Obama was supposed to go to the World Cup, but we understand South Africa has expressed security concerns about him coming. He may not attend. What would his presence have meant there?
That would have been a huge event. He's a wildly popular figure in South Africa.
A father from Kenya.
Yeah. There's a chance he may still go if the United States do well. Joe Biden's going. But I think having Obama there would have been a huge public event.
Well, and I guess bringing it back to this idea that this is South Africa, first time in Africa, what are the storylines that surround this? We're reading that Louise Taylor wrote in The Guardian a piece titled "Why Going to South Africa for the World Cup Terrifies Me," noting it has the world's highest murder rate, the highest rate of HIV infection.
I think regardless of what the reality is, it's going to be tough because that perception of South Africa as either unstable or unsafe has really affected foreign fans coming to the tournament. And FIFA, for the first time ever at a World Cup, has actually struggled to sell the amount of tickets. So there's a chance, and this would be a tragedy, that there are going to be World Cup stadiums which aren't sold out, where there's entire empty sections.
You know, it's a double-edged sword. These sorts of events in the past have always been given to highly industrialized rich nations. And FIFA decided, and I think they're to be applauded for this, that we want other nations to have a chance to host this great tournament. The flip side of it is you do that and you run the risk that more people may not want to come.
But Stephen, as you said, it would be a shame if people don't pay attention. Harrison, tell us why. What will make us riveted?
You're going to see truly global encounters that wouldn't be witnessed anywhere else. Somebody once compared the World Cup to a game of Risk on haywire. You're going to have teams like Cameroon playing Denmark, Switzerland against Chile, just these matchups that would never happen anywhere else.
Who are the great teams?
The same as they always are. Even though there's this perception that the World Cup is a tournament like March Madness, something to throw up that anyone can win, the same four teams tend to win the World Cup with the exception of host countries. And those teams are Brazil, Argentina, Italy, and Germany. And it rings true this time as well. Argentina and Brazil are very strong. Spain is also considered good, but there's a lot of underdog teams. Ghana could be good. Serbia could be good. And when the tournament's held outside of Europe or South America, like it was in Asia in 2002, odd things start to happen. There's normally more upsets.
So who might be a dark horse?
We think Ghana could definitely be a dark horse to make a run for it.
I think on paper, Spain has the best team. But Spain, as Harrison said, always underperforms. And if you look at the history of Spain, it's a country in which there's not a strong central sense of identity. The people in Rio, in Madrid, don't like the people in Barcelona. The Catalans don't like the Andalusians. You know, the old baseball saying, 25 players, 25 cabs. Well, there's a saying in Europe, 4 Spaniards, 5 opinions. And what you've tended to have is a team very talented that doesn't get along with one another. This time, the team is very strongly Catalan. And there's a chance that that may give that team the core to do very well.
And what about players? Harrison, just throw out some names and what makes them electric.
Lionel Messi is definitely a player to watch. He's Argentinian, therefore plays for the Argentinian national team, but he plays his club football for Barcelona in Spain. And because of that, he spent almost his entire adult life in Spain. So there have been questions as to how Argentinian is he. And there have been accusations that he's more Catalan than Argentinian.
Meaning that his heart's with Spain.
His heart's with Spain, exactly. Because he has a tendency to play better for Barcelona than he does for Argentina. If Argentina can find a way to unleash him, I think they'll do very well. It's interesting, though, because he's drawn so many comparisons to Diego Maradona, who this time is the Argentinian coach. There have been suggestions that Maradona is deliberately undermining Messi because he wants to stay as the greatest player in Argentinian history.
Aha. Dramas like that I can follow.
There's thousands of them.
So many.
Well, give us one more, Stephen.
Oh, well, the French have a coach named Raymond Domenech, a.k.a. Le Crackpot. One thing you notice with the World Cup is, unlike the American model, where coaches all tend to say sort of the same cliches and which don't mean anything, the World Cup attracts characters, and Domenech is typical. Former player, most of the French people hate him. He tends to make his coaching choices through astrology. Once refused to pick a player because he said he's a Leo and he's going to want to show us up sometime. picked another player because his chart was right. And he tends to do things very instinctually. And that's the kind of coaches you get at this kind of an event.
And it's the kind of person you want to tune in to watch. And I've been told that your top 10 players are almost like a new slate. You're not going to see Beckham. Tell us a little bit about that. Who's not going to be there from the soccer world?
David Beckham's not going to be there because, unfortunately, he tore his Achilles tendon. And there was doubts as to whether or not he was going to be on the team anyway. Perhaps the most striking omission is the player who appears on our cover. Ronaldinho, one of the most recognizable faces in soccer, has been deliberately left off the Brazilian team because of a history of more or less partying.
Oh, wait a minute. It's Brazil. You know, that's sort of their national pastime, but still?
It absolutely is. But it's interesting. The Brazilian coach has very much tried to eradicate that segment of the team. Ronaldinho's missing. A similar player, Adriano, who played in 2006, is missing. And instead, he's gone with a very much more organized, disciplined contingent of Brazilian players who don't necessarily represent the Brazil we're used to seeing.
Well, one last thing I have to ask you both. Stephen and Harrison Stark, their new book is an unbelievable guide. You know, I don't follow the game as much as I'd like, and it's just fun to read. their guide to World Cup 2010. And each of the teams, after you profile the team, you give us all sorts of stats, tactics, management, and Beatles song that best describes the team. Oh, well, let's just pick Ghana, because you said Ghana is a team that you like. Our producer, Chris Ballman, likes Ghana. What would be the Beatles song that would describe Ghana and why?
Getting better.
All the time.
Ghana is a country that is vastly improving. And it's interesting, their popularity in the African continent is improving. They've got an excellent mix of homegrown Ghanaian players combined with a bunch of players who have grown up in Europe and played the majority of their soccer in Europe. And as the birthplace of Pan-Africanism, there's an appeal to Ghana playing in South Africa that's going to electrify the entire continent. If South Africa go out, the hosts will throw their weight behind Ghana, and they could well be the most popular African team at the tournament.
Mm-hmm. Well, in their honor, little Beatles.
Getting so much better all the time.
Harrison and his dad, Stephen Stark, their book, again, World Cup 2010, The Indispensable Guide to Soccer and Geopolitics. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
BP has agreed to expedite the process for those seeking payment for losses due to the oil blowout. Welcome news to the estimated 40,000 people who make their living fishing the Gulf of Mexico. But about half of them are Vietnamese. Most came to the U.S. in the late 70s and early 80s as refugees from the war and took up fishing because that's what they did back home. They established close-knit communities along the Gulf that provided support. But that's created something of a problem as Vietnamese fishermen try to cope with the BP oil disaster. Tuan Nguyen is deputy director of the Mary Queen of Vietnam Community Development Corporation in New Orleans. And Tuan, it's been decades since many of these people came here, but we understand the problem is many still can't speak English.
Yes, very limited English if they have any.
So what are some of the problems that arise because of that?
They simply don't understand what's going on, what the situation is. And on top of that, when they have any documentations that are not translated appropriately, they don't know what they're signing on to either.
Well, let's take that one at a time. People are trying to put in claim forms, trying to get some money back for time lost. BP has a 1-800 phone number, and they do have some translators. Is that not helping?
I think what it is even though they have translators, you have to ask the question of whether they're properly trained or not, one. And two, are they dispersing the information as needed? Because a lot of times people leave claims offices and they still don't know what's going on.
And some of the problems are problems for other people. For a long time, not a lot of Americans knew what a dispersant was. But for instance, the word dispersant, how does that have to be translated?
Usually the best way to translate it is to explain what it is. Like say, for example, like boom, right? We would explain it as a floating device that captures the oil.
Right, a dispersant, for instance, has to be translated as the chemical that breaks up the oil so it will sink to the floor.
Exactly. Yeah. That's how you would have to translate and interpret things.
Well, because of this, many Vietnamese aren't filing for lost income, but they're also getting locked out of the cleanup efforts. How so?
Simply because there's too many vessels and fishermen that apply for the Vessel of Opportunities program. And from what we understand from BP, there are 16,000 approved boats to be deployed to do the cleanup. But as of a couple of weeks ago, there's like only 1,000 have been active.
And the Vietnamese fishermen may not have gotten in with those first several thousand because, again, of the language difficulties.
I remember 1 week they gave us a number that they reported, and a third of them were Vietnamese vessels, but I haven't heard of any updates since. So I can only assume it's probably not Vietnamese Americans that are being called.
Do the fishermen truly understand how dangerous the oil and dispersants in the water are?
No, they have no idea. They just want to work, Robin. And at the end of the day, that's all they care about. They just want to work.
What are some of the other problems that the language barrier has led to? We understand some people being taken advantage of.
As soon as this disaster happened, they had these lawyers come in from Miami, from Houston, and told these people, you got to sign on with me or else you're not going to get any settlements or any payments from BP. Actually, one gentleman signed a contract thinking it was a BP contract.
Well, and in fact, it's not. And in some cases, these lawyers are asking them to sign papers that wind up giving the lawyer as much as 40% of any settlement.
Yeah. There was a fisherman who called me Sunday evening and said they received a letter from the lawyer. They gave it to a friend who can read it. It says that they have to turn in the check, the initial payment that BP gave them.
Well, Tuan Nguyen, again from the Mary Queen of Vietnam Community Development Corporation in New Orleans. I'm wondering, too, if you're also talking about what might be a cautionary tale here. Is there something to be learned here in the community about, whether maybe more people need to learn English?
Well, it's hard to say that because we have to be able to retain the culture. There's a portion of my generation that cannot read or write, or if they do, they do very little. And so it's very, very important that we try to retain our language and our culture.
Because yours is a refugee population, I'm presuming, from the South, that came here because you fought and made sacrifices for the U.S. during the war. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, we fought alongside the U.S. just as, you know, against the communists as well as the U.S. did. So, you know, like I said, I think it goes back to, you know, learning English is a wonderful thing, but it's so important to retain the language and the culture because if they're not speaking it, then my generation and the generation behind me are not going to speak it and retain the cultures as well.
That's Tuan Nguyen, Deputy Director of the Mary Queen of Vietnam Community Development Corporation in New Orleans, serving the Vietnamese fishermen there. Tuan, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
The technology that BP is relying on to clean up oil from the Gulf well is the same technology that was used during the Exxon Valdez spill more than 20 years ago. Massachusetts Congressman Ed Markey wants to change that by forcing oil companies to pay into a fund to research and develop new technologies, something he says was underscored by BP's early suggestion for plugging the well.
In that first week, BP was saying they were going to be shooting golf balls down into this oil leak. People really felt that it would be MIT and not the PGA that BP would be talking about. It's clear they just never made the proper investment in those new technologies.
Well, we're also looking at booms that we know the waves with oil go over, so the booms are outdated and there's not even enough of the booms. But Congressman, a question, people can see that this is outdated, but how did this go on for so long? Where was this proposal years ago?
That is a very good question, and I think it goes right to this cozy relationship that existed between the oil companies and the MMS, the Minerals Management Service, in the Department of Interior. They basically accepted the promises made by the oil industry that they could drill safely and that they could handle any size spill. In truth, they couldn't. They saw it as an area where they could save money in research and development of new safety technologies, new boom technologies. We having completed the research that would ensure the chemicals that are shot into the ocean are safe and would have no effect upon the food chain or human beings. None of that was done, and it is a failure of the government.
So you're looking to get money from companies to put into this fund, but you're also looking to recover monies that we now know have been lost because of flaws in previous laws. Tell us about that.
The law that was passed in 1995, the Deepwater Royalty Relief Act, and a court challenge from some oil companies has made it possible for some oil producers that received leases between 1996 and 2000 in the Gulf of Mexico to drill on public land for free. What my bill would do is to create a fund to support the badly needed investments in developing the new technologies by recovering oil company payments, roughly $50 million annually, but much larger numbers in the years ahead.
The question is, again, and it may have the same answer, how were they able to drill for free? This is supposed to be land leased from the United States government.
You've got an absolute scandal here. The oil companies felt that they found a loophole. They were able to exploit it. But we could pass legislation that would force them to either pay the royalties or be denied the ability to be able to drill and apply for new leases.
You've been at hearings down in the Gulf region. What are you hearing?
Two of the widows who testified have only met BP officials at the funerals for their husbands. Fishermen were saying that notwithstanding how much money they made last year in fishing in the month of May of 2009, BP is just giving them $5,000, even if, as fishermen, they have tax records and other documents to prove they made five times that last year in the same month. The human tragedy as it is unfolding in slow motion is just something that we have to respond to. These people's lives and livelihoods are going to be changed for a generation. And then I was able to go out to see the marshes 2 feet high above the surface of the water is an oil stain all across the marsh, a hurricane would just flood this entire area. And for those of us who live in New England, as I do, many of the fish off of Georgia's Bank actually begin their life down in the Gulf of Mexico, where all of the spawning begins. And so this could have long-term catastrophic impact up around the Atlantic, up the Mississippi River. It is BP's spill. It is America's ocean.
Democratic Congressman Ed Markey. Congressman Markey, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, many of your letters this week have been about the Gulf, one story in particular. We spoke with Volunteer Fire Chief James Hinton of Magnolia Springs, Alabama, who had organized a community effort to line up barges across the mouth of a small bay to protect a 6,000-acre estuary because he felt booms alone wouldn't work. Well, he was right. Oil has now washed over booms in nearby Perdido Pass, so golf-sized, greasy tar balls are scattered along beaches in Baldwin County, where Chief Hinton lives. We reached him this morning.
Effectively, yesterday, they lost part of Baldwin County. It's weighing hard on me right now that they've now got oil in the marshes and the grass and reed beds over around Orange Beach, Alabama, along with Perdido Beach, Alabama. And it's something we're trying to prevent from happening here, but the more contamination we get around us, the harder it's going to be to prevent contamination. You know, if we can block off and protect our little piece, but with contamination all around us, it's bound to keep washing through on the outside, and it's lost a part of Alabama now.
Listener Candace Pierce of Grand Rapids, Michigan, was one of many who wrote wanting to contribute to his efforts. Here's his response.
Any contributions will be appreciated. This is going to be a long haul, and we're in it for the long run. I'm going to do my best to get other communities along the coast to do what we did and try to form their own groups and come up with their own ideas and see what we can make happen.
The Magnolia Springs Fire Department has set up a special account to try to block the oil. To find out how you can help, go to hereandnow.org. Couple other thoughts from you. We also reported on North Dakota's land oil boom. Hundreds of new workers and oil companies bringing in revenue but straining the infrastructure. Jim Fralich in eastern Montana felt we didn't touch on the environmental concerns, like the method of drilling that oil companies use. It's called fracking.
Fracking can pollute the groundwater. This huge profits that people with the mineral rights are making forces prices up and nobody else can compete. And he didn't talk about pipelines associated with the oil boom.
And one last thought from you for some much needed levity. Lauren Stanton of Prairie Village, Kansas, thought we should have given some warning before our piece on the wild baboons swarming the streets of South Africa ahead of the World Cup. Lauren writes, "There I am chowing down on my leftover KFC when you guys feature audio of copulating baboons. I'm no prude, but only Curious George could have loved that gem." Well, sorry about that. Your thoughts, go to hereandnow.org. Click on Contact Us. Back in a minute, Here and Now. It's June, wedding season. Once upon a time, it was just the man who proposed. Most of the time, it was a surprise, and the woman might hope for a proposal but not have much say in the matter. Well, that's changed. Today, it's more of a negotiation and a subject of research. Sociologist Amanda Miller teaches at the University of Central Oklahoma. Her paper on proposals is called Waiting to be Asked. She joins us on the line from Edmond, Oklahoma. And Amanda, tell us more. An engagement negotiation. Now, a lot of people listening know what you're talking about because they've done this. But what does that phrase mean to you?
An engagement negotiation is a situation in which couples mutually decide when to marry, that they'll marry, how that engagement sometimes even will take place. And this is something that's more common among middle-class individuals, where female partners have more power in terms of negotiating the wedding.
Because they often have an income.
Because they often have an income, and also more education seems to afford them more power within their relationships. And so what's happening is that instead of there being this grand surprise proposal, the couple will sit down and she'll say, hey, honey, you know, a friend of mine's getting married, and I'd kind of like for us to be married. When do you think we might do that? And then the couple might talk together about a timeline that fits with both of their work schedules. in rare instances, women are even scripting their marriage proposals, saying things like, I've always wanted to be proposed to in a horse-drawn carriage.
So more than negotiating it, they're helping to write it. Now, you know a thing or two about this. Is this something you went through?
I told my now husband, I'm moving away to go to graduate school, and I would love for you to go with me. And my husband oh so romantically turned to me and said, well, you know, getting married doesn't sound so bad.
So. Well, you know, you just said the key thing, because this does not sound like romance. This sounds like, you know, buying a mortgage or something. It doesn't have that sort of heart-stopping magic of what will the other person say.
What's interesting is that even though couples are deciding perhaps when to get engaged or a general timeline for doing so, the proposal is still very much the man's responsibility, according to the couples that I interviewed. So my husband and I, for example, we went and picked out rings together, and then I waited a couple of months to be proposed to. That was seen as his job, which is what the couples that I'm interviewing say.
Even though, did you tell him exactly how you wanted it done and where?
I didn't. I didn't have a script. I wanted a little bit of that magic like you're talking about.
Well, another reporting that we've seen on marriages today, we've seen this applauded because this means that people have their head on straight and they know what they really need and want, and 6 months after marriage, you don't have a sudden discovery that your partner maybe doesn't think the way that you do, so that's a good thing. And I'm also wondering if some of this has to do with the fact that some of the people I've read that you've interviewed do know each other quite well. They're often discussing this in their home together.
Couples are not really discussing marriage prior to moving in together. Cohabitation is a normative phenomenon nowadays, with most couples living together before they tie the knot. And most of the ones that we have interviewed, both working class and middle class, don't really discuss marriage with any kind of seriousness before moving in together.
Yeah. You wanted to study how marriage proposals are made because you write that not much is known about how relationships progress among couples. Have you come to a conclusion?
We believe that middle-class women in particular have more power than working-class women, at least within the context of cohabitation. Their working-class counterparts are still hinting around about marriage. They're not coming right out and saying, you know, I want us to get married and I want it to be now. But really, the proposal still remains this moment that is a male bastion. So men are still expected to do the proposing and women are still waiting to be asked, even if they're more comfortable talking about when that proposal might occur or how it might happen.
Huh.
And then working-class male partners are not very happy with this hinting. They're not as ready to get married or to tie the knot, and they're dragging their feet a little bit with this proposal. They're either intentionally being oblivious to the hints, or they're discouraging their partners from hinting. The middle-class men that we interviewed, though, seem okay with this. They seem happier about it. It's nice to know that when you do ask, the answer to the question is going to be yes.
That's Amanda Miller. She teaches sociology at the University of Central Oklahoma. Professor, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, let's bring in Josh Brenton. He blogs about being a groom for Brides Magazine and also at his own website, thegroomwithaview.com. He proposed to his girlfriend, Erica London, last June after they've been living together for over a year. They're getting married on Saturday, and he joins us from New York. Josh, first of all, congratulations.
Thanks very much.
And so does anything that we were hearing from Professor Amanda Miller resonate with you? Did you do any negotiations? Did you sit down and talk about how you guys felt about marriage once you'd moved in?
It wasn't right after we moved in. Erica started at some point asking how I felt about it and have you thought about going ring shopping yet? That sort of thing, which is hard to be oblivious to. It was also something that I'd been thinking about on my own anyway and just hadn't brought up to her, so her bringing that up was reassuring. We sort of talked about when it might be, just in terms of, well, would June be good or would September be good? I definitely took the reins on the proposal itself. Erica knew that it would be forthcoming at some point, but I certainly caught her off guard with how I did it.
So, Josh, how'd you do it? How'd you propose?
It was a Sunday morning. Erica and I like to spend our mornings being lazy and reading the New York Times, and she particularly enjoys the Modern Love column in the Styles section.
Oh, sure.
So I decided to write my own Modern Love column, and it took me a couple of weeks to actually write it properly. I went through a few drafts and sort of put it down and picked it up, and by the night before, I wasn't nervous, but she could tell something was going on, but obviously I couldn't reveal what that thing was. So I started waking up every hour during the night because I wanted to make sure I got up early enough to put it in the paper for her to find it.
You're taping your piece into the Time Style section. Your hands are shaking.
Yes, it was. I dropped the tape dispenser. I thought I woke her up, but luckily I didn't. And finally, she came out a couple hours later, and almost left in the middle of reading the style section to go get a manicure, which made my heart drop for a second. But she did turn the page and found it. And as soon as she saw what it was, she knew, obviously, that that was how I was planning to propose.
Did she answer? Was it such a fait accompli that she didn't, or what?
Well, she asked if she had to read the whole thing, because it was kind of long, and she just wanted to skip to the end. But I made her read the whole thing, and then said yes, and then she read it again subsequently.
Yeah.
So it was very nice. It was, you know, we were in our pajamas on the sofa. It was I liked it. I thought it was nice for me, and it was nice for her, and it was nice as a reflection of us.
Yeah. Well, and now you're blogging about all of this. You're writing about how wedding planning is driving you crazy, one big issue, whether to buy or make those little boxes of sand to hold the place cards. You had a revelation while consulting a marathon training manual. What was that?
The marathon training manual talks about ways to get through the last 10 miles or 6 miles of a marathon without bonking, they call it, or crashing or hitting the wall. And I was really feeling that a couple of weeks ago. The longer you go in the wedding planning, the more you just want the finish line to get there. And they suggested a lot of things, such as visualizing yourself getting to that finish line. And it's very easy to get caught up when you're wedding planning in all the details and all the minutia that go along with it. But actually visualizing the night of the wedding and how it would feel and how everybody would look and the vibe of the room, when I started thinking about that, it sort of got me back on track, because it's really the bigger picture in this that counts, and the little details are important to us, but in the grand scheme of things, really don't make a difference about what we're actually doing, which is getting married.
Well, one last question. Are you going to have all your guests dance down the aisle like that woman does in that fabulous YouTube video and then they did on The Office?
We're not going to do that. I don't think we're going to have everybody seated as traditional, I think.
Well, just you wait. We'll link people to that video just because it makes you smile with everybody dancing to the wedding. Josh, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
And good luck to you.
Thank you.